uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight. It is another Moonbat edition of the show, and it is Tuesday, June 26th, 2012, into Wednesday, June 27th, 2012. Thanks so much for being with us here. Tonight, we're going to be getting into a few news stories for you, and as per usual, we'll be going through some of this craziness and madness and documenting and discussing daily world events. And then when we're done with that, we're going to move on to our continued series of reading and get into more of what I'm sure will be highly interesting tidbits of ancient societies and ancient archaeology, and continues to be fascinating stuff for me as working on a film for this, so we're going to be getting into more of that tonight. If you'd like to send emails in, you have questions, comments, if you have things you'd like to hear me talk about, you know, you say, hey, what do you know about this? And I'll go, all right, well, and I'll, you know, give you my spiel of what I know about those things. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. That's GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. That's where you send emails in anytime. You can even send them in during the show, and I check the email periodically during the show to see if we have anything coming in. So if you do want to get something in, that's where you can send it. If you're listening on an archive or a YouTube video later on and you want to send something in, feel free to do that as well. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. My website where this broadcast originates from is TheGlobalReality.com. It's TheGlobalReality.com. Newly redesigned. You'll find all the things pertaining to my work up there at that website. And we've got news for you up there, links to listen to the stream, which runs 24 hours a day and plays repeats of the shows, then the most recent shows, and some older shows, too, and a lot of different stuff on the weekends and stuff and late-night stuff. So all the archives are there as well. We have all my documentary films up there from my first film, 9/11 New World Rising, which came out in 2007. To The Seeing Right Volume 2, which came out last year, and video clips, all that stuff up there, chat room as well. And this is our fundraising week for the network. We have 39% goal reached for this month. So we have roughly 900 left to go. So if we have 18 listeners, and I know there's way more than 18 of you out there that could donate $50. There's got to be, because I see how many listeners we have, how many YouTube videos we have, how many likes and reposts we've had on our Kickstarter. That blows my mind, too. That's another one of those, you know, 124 likes, and I've seen at least 40 or 50 different shares of this and, you know, people's reaction. But we've had 7 backers, and we have $215 so far. It just, you know, it doesn't make any sense. So the people who, there's way more people out there interested in it, but, yeah, I am going to be exploring options, to take just all my stuff, and, make it all monetized. And I'm really it's getting to be time because, well, only strictly because so many of you out there have told me that I should. That's the main reason. Forget everything else. That's the main reason. And I got an email along those lines tonight I'll read for you as well. But 18 people out there donating $50, which would also get you in on the drawing for Friday night for the Global Reality All-Stars. 18 people at, or 36 at 25, however you want to look at it. But at the $50 level there, 18 people, that'll be 18 more into the drawing, and we're going to have two drawings that night, so it's going to be good. It's going to be hot and heated, man. People are going to be, there's going to be fierce competition for this, you know what I mean? People are going to be really bucking for the gates on this one. it is cool to see, but anyway, yeah, we've got to get that amount in by Friday, no later than Friday, to get all the operating costs and all that bullshit handled, you know? That's how they rob us, man. That's how they keep us from ever doing anything, and they just fucking stay, you know, always got a fee for you or some charge or, you know. That's the thing. I'm just lucky that a lot of my equipment is held up as long as it has. Anyway, thegoldmorality.com, please go in there and support our work and help us reach that goal. The sooner the better so we can get on with it and get on with our business. We've only got about $10 in so far this week, so, you know, there you go. Police in northern New Jersey are trying to identify a man who was found wandering naked through the woods yesterday afternoon. This is a very strange story. The man was taken to Bergen Regional Medical Center for evaluation because he could not provide any information on his identity or where he was from. A passerby called police after encountering the naked man in Mahwah, Jersey. He's like the fucking Starman, dude. You ever see that movie? It came out in the 80s with Jeff Bridges. Went and saw that shit at the theater when I was like 10. It was the bomb, dude. Remember that? But that's what happened when, you know, he came. He was an alien, and when they found him, he was all like out in New Jersey or somewhere in the desert or something. I don't remember where it was. I want to say it was Jersey, but I could be wrong about that. I hadn't seen that movie in a while, but, you know, they found him naked. Mahwah Police Chief James Battelli told the Star-Ledger of Newark that officers found the man off Route 202 unclothed and covered in mud on Sunday. Now, this is the strange part. Battelli says that the man has no signs of head trauma or injuries that could have caused memory loss. So this guy really just got shit out of... isn't this how superhero movies start? Police found clothing that could have belonged to the man in the wooded area, but no documents provided a clue to his identity. Anyone who knows him is asked to contact Mahwah Police. It's just strange. This guy just, you know, drops out of nowhere, and in this day and age, you know, should be pretty easy to identify somebody, but if he hadn't lost his, you know, he's just like a blank slate. That's just strange. But yeah, I think a lot of superhero movies start like that, don't they? With a recent spate of bizarre flesh-eating criminals being arrested across the U.S., there have been rumors of pending zombie apocalypse, and one New England town is taking no chances. It has just held a zombie apocalypse day to train emergency services how to respond to an attack of the undead. I am not making this up. This is not The Onion. Perhaps not coincidentally, that town was Bangor, Maine, where legendary horror author Stephen King lives, so it should be well prepared for a supernatural outbreak. The Zombie Apocalypse Day was attended by dozens of emergency workers from hospitals, public safety bodies, and the National Guard, according to the Bangor Daily News. Now, that's interesting. If they were just doing this to have fun, why is the fucking National Guard involved? Why is emergency workers, the hospitals, and public safety bodies involved? You know what I mean? It really just seems like, you know, they're acclimating people. Get ready to, you know, this is what you're going to see. That way when it happens, you know, you won't freak out as bad because your mind will just disassociate it. I don't know, dude. It just seems weird. And while the event had a lighthearted tone, it was at heart a serious attempt to try and train first responders and how to deal with an outbreak of a serious infectious disease. The scenario involved locals falling prey to a zombie plague, which originated in Jamaica and was spread by bites. The zombies were given their blood-curdling appearance by Don Wade, a makeup expert who specializes in creating artificial wounds for medical and military training. Now, yeah, because one of these looks absolutely real. I was like, geez, you look like you could see, you know, inside of, under the skin down to the bone, rotting flesh. And I was like, that looks, you know, somebody just didn't whip that up with some $2.99 Halloween makeup you get down at the Five and Dime. No, that's some sophisticated stuff. So I like how they bring this military expert in to make the zombie wounds look more realistic for the trauma-based mind control. I mean, this is just unbelievable. And that's absolutely what this is a trauma-based mind control operation, no question about it. They wouldn't be they wouldn't be using this many resources, ladies and gentlemen, if they weren't doing that. Usually it's cuts, burns, amputations, and heart attacks and that kind of thing. He said, I have all the props for that. Today was the first time I ever had to do zombies, the makeup artist said. Participants who had been infected and became zombies aimed to attack other to infect them, too. When someone was bitten, he had to find someone to administer a vaccine to him quickly or turn into a zombie himself. This forced emergency workers to make decisions about how to ration out medicines and what to do when faced with mass casualties. This is a fucking drill. This is, that's what I'm saying. This is odd. But they dress it up as funny. Fun, ha, 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 you know, we're just having fun here. No. That's a facade. They're doing this under the guise of, oh, they're just having fun. This is an actual drill. They would not be using this many resources, ladies and gentlemen, not in this economy. You know how many cities we have going under in the United States? Stockton, California. Stockton, California, done. Bankrupt. They're going under. The whole city's going under. It's happening all over the place. Do you really think in this day and age they'd be wasting all these resources to just have a fun little goofy zombie apocalypse drill? No, something's going on. I mean, when I saw the CDC back in 2009 running these analysis on this, they said the same thing. Oh, we were just having some fun. Right. We use CDC resources and their supercomputers to run algorithms just to have some fun. Just to see, oh, well, let's see what's the likelihood of survival in the event of a zombie apocalypse, just for fun. Not buying it for a second. They've been doing this and saying this, and they've been putting this out in the media, and they've made it a meme. I've said this for the longest time. They fictionalize the truth, so the truth seems like fiction. That's what they've done for years. The X-Files was great at that. They would always do that in the X-Files stuff. To build it up in people's minds that these things are fiction and everything else, so that when they encounter real information about these things being real, they have a disassociation. They go, oh, well, that's, you know, that was just from that TV show or that movie or whatever. That blows me away. I thought maybe this was just some trauma-based mind control because of the makeup thing, but That right there tells you this was an actual drill. I think it's probably some sort of, you know, weaponized Ebola. Well, there's all kinds of stuff out there that they could use. But it does make you wonder if these priest class guys have been engineering. And I believe they've been technologically engineering the apocalypse for quite some time. And by that, I mean, you know, I mean, the Bible talked about the dead, you know, the dead rising and walking and all that stuff. I think these guys are trying to, as I've talked about in a lot of the research into the CMP, trying to bring about their apocalypse that they've prophesized and is talked about in religious texts. And if that means using the best technology in the world to fake it and make people believe it's real, you don't think they'll do that to get total control? Absolutely they will. And I think it's a possibility, and I think it is at least a possibility worth putting on the table. They have the technology to do this. They have weaponized Ebola. They have all these different strains, all of these various bioweapons things that they've been messing with. You acclimate people to these with these zombie movies and these zombie games. It's no question they create video games as training. Hell, I was watching a Robotech cartoon from the fucking 80s the other day. And there was a thing in there where these two warriors were playing a video game, and this one of them was an alien, and she says, oh, they use these games to train their warriors. And the ones who are good at them, you know, go on and go into real battle. And they made that movie in the 80s, too, the Last Starfighter. That was sort of the same thing. Guy goes and plays video games, really good at it, and gets fucking drafted into, you know, an intergalactic space war. But it does seem that they are using the meme of zombies and zombie apocalypse and making this a part of popular culture, and then with this basalt thing coming right on time with this, and really with this wrong association of zombies with the effects of what bath salts are doing to people, it's not even zombie behavior when you really look at it. But still, there's that continued connection to that. And so there's obviously something going on where they're either planning to, you know, technologically engineer the apocalypse. That could be, people have speculated for years they were going to do the blue beam thing and, you know, holograms and tell everybody all the world's religions have been misinterpreted. And then there's going to be a sky show with all of the, you know, religious deities, and they're all going to fly into one and create one Maitreya. All, you know, you have misinterpreted all world religions. All world religions are actually Maitreya. Dun, 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 you know, and then we're all supposed to worship this one God. And then, of course, people who believe that to be a false, you know, whatever, or you know, the Christians, well, they'll fucking all hang themselves or whatever. And the fucking Muslims will start going ape shit. And they'll create absolute chaos to come inside after that ensuing chaos and set up their new order. Ordo ab chao. That's their thing. That's what they do. And like I said, this seemingly on the surface kind of looked like it would be, you know, just some little fun thing. But no. I mean, they had the National Guard out there, first off. My God, emergency workers, first responders. This forced emergency workers to make decisions on how to ration out medicines and what to do in face with mass fatalities. Because the thing about it is, if there was to be some sort of real, actual zombie apocalypse, heaven forbid, that I believe it might be engineered from one of these bioweapons, because we don't know what other countries are cooking up or what they're cooking up behind closed doors to say is another country. You know what I mean? Whatever it may be. You know, they could hit us with something they've been planning for a long time and then say, oh my God, Iran, we had no idea. You know, Iran has been making a fucking zombie bomb. Jesus Christ, we did not have that intelligence. We didn't get to monitor your computers enough, so we didn't get that knowledge. Just like 9/11, we didn't have enough info being exchanging hands, so we weren't able to tell they were going to attack us, even though there was people like John O'Neill screaming they were going to attack us, and they killed him too. That's either here nor there, I guess. But it, you know, there's no precedent for this kind of thing. So if they were planning to do something like this, some sort of attack like this, either their side, our side, or, you know, the people up top that want to blame it on their side or our side, right? That's how it always goes. There's no training for that, right? And the only way you're going to get training is to do it like you're doing it for real, but how do you hide that from the general public without causing a panic? Well, you start creating the meme and popular culture through the horror movies. The thing is, the past generation of the past 10 years or so, there's this thing with teenagers. When teenagers are in high school and stuff, it's like Friday night, you know, going to movies. And so for the past 10 years, I noticed that during the school year, like in the fall especially, there's around Halloween, every year there's new zombie movies coming out. All the video games, Left 4 Dead and all this stuff, they're all zombie games. And it's just zombie meme constantly. And, you know, I don't even get into this stuff. And I had a while back, I guess about a year or so ago, I've never even got into this. And I had the most vivid dream I've ever had in my life. absolutely most picture movie perfect dream, if just littered with symbology as well. And it was zombie apocalypse ring. And I, you know, and it was the goddamnedest thing because I've never gotten into that stuff. I don't play those kind of video games. I don't typically watch a lot of zombie apocalypse movies. I mean, I've seen some. Everybody's seen one or two, right? But it's not, I mean, I don't obsess over the genre. It's not something I've ever even thought about. Really, honestly, until 2009, when I saw the study that the CDC did, really up until that point, I thought it was just a goofy, funny, you know, horror. People are into horror movies. You know, some people, there's goth people, and they were fucking obsessed with horror films and stuff. And so that's what I thought it was for the longest time, was just an obsession with the horror film culture, because that's always been there. And I figured it would always be there, but then it sort of morphed into this zombie thing, and I didn't realize that, you know, people were really believing that might happen. But they made enough movies about it. My God, how many fucking zombie apocalypse movies are there? There's tons, going back to, you know, Night of the Living Dead and a million in between. And what's funny is in all of them, what I always thought was kind of interesting is that in all of those old movies, going back to the original ones, in all of them, it was always some government experiment, wasn't it? It was always some, you know, some military cargo train carrying some tank, and it fucking derails and crashes and lets out this, you know, bioweapon, and the whole goddamn town turns into zombies. And of course, you know the rest, chaos ensues, and axes are, you know, fucking brains are eaten. It's terrible. But, really, that's a constant theme in all of them. That's what I think is most worrisome, is that it kind of seems like they've been, you know, programming us to sort of get acclimated to this as a reality. And there was one I watched a few years ago. I think it was the remake of The Crazies, which was a George Romero film originally. George Romero, I think George Romero did the original, I believe. The remake was interesting because after the shit goes down, they literally show FEMA camps. I mean, it's absolutely what it is, internment camps. And seeing these kind of resources put towards this, I mean, this is just unbelievable. Jesus Christ. We're gonna need your donations this week for sure, because I need to go to Home Depot and buy me three or four good fucking axes and get a motherfucking sharpened. Because Jesus Christ, as we had to fucking fend off zombies, y'all. I wasn't planning on this shit. I got other things, better things to do. Please, can we just forgo the zombie apocalypse and go to asteroids or UFOs or one world religion or something? Can we just forgo the fucking zombie apocalypse? Because zombies are messy and nasty. And they're rude. And nobody likes to have to put a fucking bullet in their, you know, some relative zombie head. That would just not be any fun, you know? But back to what I was saying earlier, I had this absolutely insane dream. Zombie apocalypse dream. And it was crazy. I saw people walk, an exodus of people, millions of people walking down the big highway that runs through Dallas here, Interstate 35. Just walking in droves, millions of people. And I was by myself, and nobody I knew was around. And the shit had gone down, and everything looked pretty deserted. I don't know where I'd been. It was like I kind of just came out of it, woke up somewhere, and was like, the shit, it had already pretty much gone down, and pretty much everybody had already bailed out of town. And those that hadn't were, you know, in a mass exodus walking in the middle of the highway, you know, getting the fuck out of town. So then I found myself in Memphis, Tennessee, and I saw Sun Records, the old great record label there, Carl Perkins, Elvis Presley, you know, the birthplace of rock and roll. And it was up, the whole entire town of Memphis was flooded, and Sun Records was up on the top of this hill, and it was completely untouched. And it's interesting when you think about the connections to Egypt with, you know, the sun. The Memphis itself being a city in Egypt, you know, the Nile, you know, running through like the Mississippi does. I mean, it's very interesting. They built a big glass pyramid there now that's a Bass Pro Shop. I saw it when I was coming back from my shooting trip back in April. But, yeah, I mean, just very, very symbolic. And I was in this aircraft hangar, and I saw, fucking, I told you this before, but I saw this zombie. There was a fucking Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day. And I don't listen to Green Day, and I don't like them. And I liked them when I was fucking 17. Who didn't, right? He's coming like, Billy Joe Armstrong, man. Do you have that time? So this guy just, you know, one day, I mean, he's coming for me. He's about to eat my brains. And I'm like freaking out because I'm like, holy shit, it's Billy Joe Armstrong. He's going to eat my fucking brains. This sucks. I have no weapon. And out of the corner of my eye, I see this guy like running up out of the side of my peripheral vision. He's got a bat with a bunch of fucking spikes through it, nails through it. And he just fucking one times Billy Joe Armstrong in the skull. And his whole head exploded like, I mean, more realistic than any headshot you've ever seen in a video game, dude. I saw the layers of the skin and the fat come apart from the skull and saw the bone shatter in two and the eyeballs shoot out the front like it was a fucking movie, dude. I've never, and the thing is, I can remember long stretches and passages of this dream. Most of the time, I never remember anything from my dreams. Not ever enough to really remember much. Sometimes, but not like this. Not like this. This was strong. And I was not on any hallucinogenic substances, nor had I been on any recently. I was not drunk. I was not high, not anything. I was completely sober when I had this, and I don't know. Everybody I've told it to has like been kind of freaked out because they've been like, that sounds like a fucking prophecy. And then all this, all this stuff that's been in the news, and now this absolute, no question drill going on in all places, Bangor, Maine. Time is running out to get serious about fixing the problem of space debris, experts say. As more countries around the world build up their space capabilities, U.S. lawmakers are keen to address the growing issue of potentially harmful debris in orbit. But while policies have attempted to tackle the problem, no major strides have been made. In 2010, the White House released its sweeping national space policy for the country, which identified orbital debris and the long-term sustainable use of space as clear priorities. But so far, few changes have been implemented on the ground or in space, said Brian Whedon, a technical advisor for the Secure World Foundation, an organization dedicated to the peaceful use of outer space. And they've already said within a few years from now, I mean, we won't be able to get anything in or outer space, of space. That there's already so much space junk up there that if we don't start doing something about this pretty soon, it's almost like they're doing it intentionally, you know? Keep anything from getting out or anything from coming in. I mean, it really does feel like they're turning our planet into a giant prison complex. Google has created an artificial brain from 16,000 computer processors and sat it down with an internet connection. There's a certain grim inevitability to the fact that the YouTube company's creation began watching stills from cat videos. Oh, shit. So even the AI goes for the cat videos first, like the, oh, Long Johnson, oh, Long Johnson, like all that shit. Oh, my God. This is not good. The team led by Google's Dr. Jeff Dean used the 16,000 processor array to create a brain-style neural network with more than a billion connections. The team then fed it random images culled from 10 million YouTube videos and let it learn by itself. Unsurprisingly, the machine focused in on cats. We never told it during the training, this is a cat. It basically invented the concept of a cat. Wow, that's scary as fuck. Contrary to what appears to be a widely held intuition, our experimental results reveal that it is possible to train a face detector without having to label images as containing a face or not, says the team in a paper published this week. We also find that the same network is sensitive to other high-level concepts, such as cat faces and human bodies. Starting with these learned features, we trained our network to obtain a 15.8% accuracy in recognizing 20,000 object categories from ImageNet, a leap of 70% relative improvement over the previous state of the art. The brain was a creation of the company's Blue Sky Ideas Lab, Google X. The lab is reportedly located in Google's Mountain View, California headquarters, known as the Googleplex. Engineers are free to work on projects such as connected fridges that order groceries when they run low, or even tableware that connect to social networks. So these are the guys. This is like their DARPA, the Google's version of DARPA. Very strange. So it can it learns what a cat is without ever having anything, even been told that it's a cat or anything else. So that's not good. All I hear is dun 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 dun. Come with me if you want to live. Really, seriously. Fucking Skynet. Boy, this doesn't tell you what you already know or already should know about just how fake everything is, especially politics and all the shit they show you on TV. Politician accidentally releases four pre-taped responses to the Supreme Court Obamacare decision days before the verdict is even announced. Isn't that great? So they already had their responses ready. So that goes to show you right there that this decision that they hand down has already been decided. Announcing to the public is strictly a formality. And so they know ahead of time so they can get their responses prepared what the decision is going to be. And then they roll it out to the public and act like they just found out too. Bullshit. Politicians are often criticized for using canned responses and working in sound bites. Once a senatorial candidate in Indiana will have a tough time rebuking those claims, however, after he accidentally released four video responses to the impending Supreme Court decision on President Obama's health care plan. Richard Murdoch accidentally posted four different taped responses to the various possible outcomes for the Supreme Court decision, which will be released on Thursday. Oh, so he just was pre-taping all, whether it was one way or the other. Well, okay. That's framed a little differently. I can see that. This made it sound, the headline made it sound as if, you know, they already knew ahead of time what it was going to be, so they already had their response rolled out. But he just taped all the variety of different ones. Okay. All right, well. Another zombie-like attack. Man eats family dog after police say he ingested synthetic drug K2. Well, that's good quality right there. Police in Waco arrested 22-year-old Michael Daniel Monday after they say he ate a dog. Family members called police on June 14th saying Daniel assaulted police at home, chased a neighbor, and started barking and growling. What happened next? We probably had, what was it, killed Robert Johnson in like some kind of venereal disease that makes you go crazy, and he was acting like a dog. What happened next is horrific. Witnesses say Daniel grabbed the family dog, beat and strangled it, and then started to eat it. The dog died at home. Daniel is believed to have been on a bad trip from ingesting K2, a synthetic drug. He was taken to the hospital, now faces a felony charge for animal cruelty. I wondered if this K2 was like the bath salts thing or what's been going on with that. You know, it's just hilarious. But that, you know, again, zombies don't really, they're after brains most of the time, you know? They're like, rah, rah, this guy was just going nuts. There have been people who hadn't been able to handle their shit for a long time. I personally think that you shouldn't do any chemicals. There are so many naturally occurring psychotropic substances on this planet that naturally occur. There should never be any need for you to ever take any chemical of any kind for any ailment. After hunting for buried treasure for three decades and not finding a great deal, Even the most diligent of us might have given up, but not Reg Mead and Richard Miles. The two amateur metal detectors kept up their search of the same area throughout the decades and have finally struck gold, or rather silver. They have unearthed the largest hoard of Celtic coins ever found. Each one of the 30,000 to 50,000 coins is estimated to be worth around 200 British pounds sterling each, putting the value of the haul at up to 10 million pounds. They are thought to be from the first century BC and were found buried 3 feet deep under a hedge in a farmer's field on Jersey. 2,000 years ago, the Channel Island, which remains a popular spot to stash large sum of money, was a refuge for tribes fleeing what is now northern France from the invading Roman armies. As the legion of Julius Caesar drew closer, the treasure is thought to have been buried by a Celtic tribe called the Corisodolae in the hopes to be dug up one day once the danger had passed. And there the coins, packed in clay and weighing a ton, have remained undisturbed until last week. The man who discovered them, Mr. Mead, 70, and Mr. Miles, a customs officer in his 40s, suspected treasure was in the area 3 decades ago when they heard rumors a farmer had found some silver pieces on his land. After a series of largely unsuccessful forays in the areas, they unearthed a stash of 120 coins in February. Mr. Mead, a grandfather who lives with wife Ruth in St. Clement, Jersey, said, "Richard found the first one, and it was amazing when you see him raising his hand above his head saying, 'Got one.'" The pair used a powerful metal detector known as a deep seeker to search for more treasure in the field and struck lucky last week. Yeah, I want one of those Ranger Tell things. You ever seen those? They're like $1,700 to get like the deluxe one. Man, I need one of those so bad for the rock wall thing. You should go check them out, though. Ranger Tell is what it is. Type Ranger Tell into a search engine and you'll be able to find that. Man, it's got like this weird calculator thing in it, and it uses Tesla technology, and it like spins around it, and you can program it with these different codes to find anything, from artifacts to coins to anything. And they're pretty freaking sweet. So yeah, these guys didn't give up, and look what they accomplished. That's a good story. This is, however, is not a good story. Japan police probe man who cooked his own genitals. He cooked his own genitals. I mean, why? What is the tactical advantage of cooking your own genitals? Tokyo police are investigating whether a man who cooked his own severed genitals and served them to 5 paying customers committed a crime or not. Jesus Christ. Wait. This guy cut his nuts off and then sold it to 5 willing customers to eat? What the fuck is wrong with Japan? I'm sorry, Japanese people. You've had your chance. And you've polluted our world and our planet with your Fukushima thing long enough. I think we should nuke Japan and just seal that motherfucker off before they can send any more rotten out into the world. Really? That's your contribution to society? People who cut their own nuts off and feed them to paying customers? Really? I've heard about this shit before, the Japanese Pain Olympics and all that stuff. I've seen that shit. Guys cut their fucking nut sacks open and pop the balls out and like play with them like marbles. What the shit is up with that? Boy, they got us right where they want us, don't they? They've gotten us to the point where we'll just cut our own shit off. Mao Sugiyama had his penis and testicles surgically removed in March and kept them frozen for 2 months before cooking them at a public event in May. Diners each paid 20,000 yen or $250 each for a portion. $250 to eat this guy's dick and balls. I can't even believe this is real. This is like from the AFP, too. This is not from the Tinfoil Times, mind you. The police probe came after the mayor of Tsunegami Ward, the Tokyo district where the event took place, said it had involved the display of obscene objects. Oh, is that all? Well, we really don't care that this man cooked and ate his own penis. I mean, it's insane. So nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with paying a man $250 to eat his cooked dick and balls. No problem with that. Cops have no problem with that. The problem is you can't show the dick and balls in public because then it's an obscene object. So you're going to have to make them into little, you know, little sushi pans, but a little wasabi on the side. Wasabi! And, you know, sprinkle it up. It's like, well, you know, it's like we've never had a case like this before. You know, we don't know what to do here. I mean, yes, technically it's wrong, but, you know, there's not any law against it. I mean, I guess if a man wants to cut his shit off and serve up his dick and balls to willing customers, hey, I guess that's his business. I just, what's really? So, do the math on this. So we had five customers, right? They paid him $250 each. And he got himself a whopping $1,250 US. You only get one dick and balls, dude. You had them surgically removed so you could get $1,200 to eat, so people could eat your dick and balls? Are they going to, like, poop it out and form you a new one out of the poop of all five people? And you're going to, like, strap it back on and use it for a while and then, you know, cut it off and cook it and serve it to somebody else? Is that the plan? Jesus. Tsunegami, a painter in his 20s who defines himself as asexual, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. In an email to AFP in May, he confirmed the event had taken place and said it was organized to raise awareness about sexual minorities, ex-gender, asexual people. In tweets on May 18th, the artist said steps were taken so his act met all relevant laws, including a ban on organ sales, processing of medical waste, and even food sanitation requirements. Tsunegami said his genitals had been removed by a physician and certified free of infections. So, did they eat them? I never got that. I'm trying to read. Yeah, I guess they did. So it went down. So this was all after the fact. Man, that is just unbelievable. Five people willingly pay $250. I bet one of them was Darth Chaney. That's just unbelievable stuff. It's come to that, huh? Well, hey, you know, we got an update on these. Remember the Millennium Falcon looking thing in the ocean? These divers have been going to investigate. We've talked about it several times here. There's been an update, and it just continues to be interesting. The divers exploring a UFO-shaped object at the bottom of the Baltic Sea say their equipment stops working when they approach within 200 meters. Dun, 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 dun. That's pretty interesting. Professional diver Stefan Hogerborn, part of the Ocean X team, which is exploring the anomaly, had some of the team's cameras and team satellites phones would refuse to work when directly above the object and would only work once they had sailed away. He is quoted as saying, "Anything electric out there and the satellite phone as well stopped working when we were above the object. And then when we got about 200 meters and it turned on again, when we got back over the object, it didn't work." Diver Peter Lindberg said, "We have experienced things that I really couldn't imagine. And I have been the team's biggest skeptic regarding these different kind of theories. I was kind of prepared just to find a stone or a cliff or an outcrop or a pile of mud that was, but it was nothing like that. So for me, it has been a missing experience, I must say. Member Dennis Asperg said, I am 100% convinced and confident that we have found something that is very, very, very unique. Then if it is a meteorite or an asteroid or a volcano or a base from, say, a U-boat from the Cold War, which was manufactured and placed there, or if it is a UFO, honestly, it has to be something. Well, something with high electromagnetic field, yeah. Probably a warp drive. It's probably something. I mean, it's probably going to be like Robotech. It's probably going to pull some ancient fucking ship out of there, and they'll back engineer it, make some big military weapon out of it. And, you know, the aliens will come down and attack and wipe out the Earth, blah, blah, blah. The object was first found in May last year. There's nothing else new, but, yeah, very strange. Equipment not working when you get over it. Electromagnetic anomalies. But I wonder if this is faked and this is some sort of, you know, this is going to be the way they're going to roll out extraterrestrials to us. Because nobody wants to come, you know, none of the countries of the world want to come on TV and go, oh, okay, look, we're going to be the ones that are going to break the ice on this, all right? Nobody wants to have to do that. But it seems to me if they had like a third party situation that could roll it out to people, you know, that would be more beneficial. I don't know. 1969 fireball meteorite reveals new ancient mineral. A fireball that tears across the sky is not just a one-time sky-watching event. It can reap scientific dividends long afterward. In fact, one that lit up Mexico's skies in 1969 scattered thousands of meteorite bits across the northern Mexico state of Chihuahua. And now, decades later, that meteorite named Allende has divulged a new mineral called Paganite. Paguite is believed to be among the oldest minerals in the solar system, which is about 4.5 billion years old. Paguite belongs to a class of refractory minerals that could have formed only under the extreme temperatures and conditions present in the infant solar system. The name of the titanium dioxide mineral, which has been approved by the International Mineralogical Association, honors Pan Gu, said in Chinese mythology to be the first living being who created the world by separating yin from yang, forming the earth and sky. Paguite is an especially exciting discovery, since it is not only a new mineral, but also a material previously unknown to science. Until now, paguite had been neither seen in nature nor created in a lab. It is brand new to science. The scientists used a scanning electron microscope to view the paguite within a so-called ultra-refractory inclusion embedded within the meteorite. So this will probably be some new unobtainium superfuel they're going to be going after now, I'm sure. Some dude cut off his own dick and balls and served it to five willing customers. My God, I still can't get over it. Do you remember how some scientists, researchers, and individuals like Bill Gates were trying to release genetically modified mosquitoes into the environment? Well, that endeavor isn't quite over. Two towns in northern Australia have recently been gifted with 10 to 20,000 genetically engineered mosquitoes, almost completely replacing mosquitoes naturally occurring in the outdoors. Although the mosquitoes released are still genetically modified, they aren't exactly the same as the more well-known mosquitoes developed by Oxitec. Oxitec is a British company responsible for the creation of the genetically engineered mosquitoes containing a gene designed to kill themselves unless given an antibiotic known as tetracycline. The company created this internally manipulated insect to help control agricultural pests and reduce insect home diseases like dengue fever and malaria. These new mosquitoes released in Australia, however, are developed with a slightly different strategy. A bacterium named Wolfback epipennis infects numerous insect species and harnesses their ability to alter its host reproductive ability. When this happens, entire populations become infected within generations. And when the bacterium infects mosquitoes, the mosquito's ability to pass the dengue virus vanishes. Needless to say, numerous scientists, researchers, and many individuals have expressed great concern regarding the release of genetically engineered mosquitoes. The first mosquito release by Oxitec took place in the Cayman Islands in the Caribbean in 2009, only for a second trial to occur in 2010, where 6,000 mosquitoes were released in Malaysia for further experiments. Now, 10 to 20,000 mosquitoes are released in Australia, drilling the environment with even more genetically modified creations. And, of course, we've already had reports that we've covered here and talked about where the mosquito populations are exploding everywhere, worldwide. So, again, you know, not getting better, probably getting worse, thanks to our usual genetically modified tinkering. I mean, look, we may have come from these genetic tinkers, but I don't think we have. I don't think we've gotten as good at this stuff yet as they have. Well, that's all the news for tonight. Not a lot of. So we're going to take a break, come back, and get into our continued series of reading for you here tonight. This is The Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. Stay with us.
Treat you unkind. let's do some living after we die.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. If you're listening to us later on an archive or a rebroadcast or a YouTube video, thank you so much for being with us as well. TheGlobalReality.com is our website. That's TheGlobalReality.com. We don't have commercials, and we don't have sponsors. We don't have any of that. All we have is you, the listening audience, those of you that appreciate our work and want to see us continue and want to see us get to those big things that are coming down the road for us, if we can just stay alive long enough to get there. TheGlobalReality.com, you can go there. There's a chipping banner on the right-hand side of the page that says that's for the monthly operating costs. And we need to reach that goal by Friday, no later than Friday. And $50 or more will get you in the drawing for the Global Reality All-Stars. We'll also announce the All-Stars for the week on Friday night when we do the drawing as well. And we're going to be giving away a couple of prizes. And the prizes are going to successfully get better. So it's going to be something you're going to want to definitely going to be an incentive for you to support our work for sure. I'll just say it like that. But please help us out. Please help us continue. And none of this is possible without you, the listener. So bear that in mind and help out our work right now, today, if you can. You can use the secure PayPal chip-in banner. You can also use the donate button put in any amount you want. And we also have the P.O. box. We absolutely can't use PayPal. And we also have the Amazon gift list to buy items we need for filmmaking and radio show and everything else. And you can do that in lieu of making a cash donation as well. So there you go. I want to read a couple of emails for you here before we get into our reading tonight. We'll be getting into Chapter 33, The Incas, More Advanced Than Imagined. And so we'll be getting into Chapter 33 for our reading, The Lost Worlds of Ancient America. Last night, Rick had sent an email asking about the Ganesha thing, and Tesla did find that picture. And actually, John Doe found it last night, Tesla, before you sent the email. Thanks to both of you guys for finding it. But yeah, my point of that was just that, and that's why I was going to wait until I had the picture, and I'm actually forwarding that to Rick right now. But why I wanted to hold off what I wanted to say till I could send this to Rick to examine himself was that from what I understand, from what I've come in my research and on top of things that Rick said in his email last night, it appears to me that Ganesha is the Hindu version of Enki, because he had great technology. This picture that you see here that I'm sending you to Rick that I was talking about shows him with these various, you know, the Hindu gods and goddesses, the blue-skinned, alien-looking ones. And I'm not even kidding you, he looks like he's about ready to do some semen porn. Straight up. He looks like he's about to get the Miller High Life picture out and just start doing some porn on these ladies. But what's interesting the most about that is that particular picture and that particular artifact was found in Ecuador, along with the Sumerian bird-looking with the cone things like we see, you know, from ancient Sumerian. So those were found in Ecuador. That was part of the Father Crespi collection. So, this giant cave complex. Yeah. So that's what's interesting to me, Rick, is that it was found with some, you know, Sumerian style, Assyrian style artifacts in this cave in Ecuador, which, you know, as I say, really goes a long way towards these, connected to these Amorites I've talked so much about. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Rick. Now, if you find any more counterparts, Rick, I know you like a challenge. Well, here's one for you. I'm not saying there isn't. And maybe I have seen it and just don't know it. But I would be interested to see what other Sumerian Hindu counterparts there are, meaning, you know, other Hindu gods or goddesses that may have counterparts in, you know, some of this Anunnaki lore or whatever. It'd be interesting to find that out. Got an email here from Louis. Louis is a new listener from the UK. I'm impressed with your interviews on Red Ice Radio. Your info was mind-blowing, and I immediately went to your website, thirsty for more. Your information puts university lecturers to shame, and you're far more entertaining. Keep up the potty mouth. I listen to you at work, and your entertaining, fast-paced humor makes my coworkers look at me in amazement as I cry with laughter. I have a few observations. Number one, you are far too soft on your fans. You provide world-class information for free when students all over the world spend thousands to be told lies and untruths. Number two, you provide a public service that blows the BBC out of the water, and in the UK they charge every household and premises with a tell-a-lie vision about $200 a year to tell lies. If you don't pay for the license, you will be fined and you could face prison. What about that for the Ministry of Truth? Number three, your information is so hard-hitting that you should be charging your students for your product. I think that you should do the same as Henrik from Red Ice and split your show in two, give your listeners a taster, and then warm them up with some facts, then present a subscriber's hour and provide all of your meaty info. You will separate the hangers-on from the real fans. You're a great scholar and a showman. People will pay for your skills. Have some confidence in yourself and rid yourself of all the parasites that are feeding off all of your skills and knowledge. You will probably feel sorry for your pals on the chat room who are funny and support your verbality. You support you verbally and you laugh and shrug it off. If you are really serious about the Rockwall work, get tough. Do not release your ancient history DVD on YouTube and copyright it. Do not give away your contents and make people pay for your material. This will have two effects. Number one, the funny, cool dudes with great chat room names and avatar pictures who have spent years listening to your hard work and research will be forced to choose between your material or being blocked out. Number two, you will make enough money to free your time up to realize your potential as a brilliant researcher and filmmaker. Number three, no more super nanny Josh Reeves. I think you're really cool, man. Can I listen to you for free and feed off your ideas like a parasite so long as I post funny pictures and good comments? No donations, of course. And I live in Miami. I just shit can you come around and wipe my butt as you do everything else for me? This guy is a hoot. Number four, get tough and you'll be surprised. You'll make more films and be more influential. Trust me, all the best. Well, thank you, Louie, and appreciate those words. And yeah, I am definitely working towards that as we speak. Just got to figure out how to get there. Well, a lot of it, you know, it takes money to get there is the main thing. I got to have startup capital to be able to buy the servers or whatever it may be, to make stuff monetized and to get stuff, to put stuff where I can charge people to download second hours and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm definitely working towards that. All right. Chapter 33, the Incas more advanced than imagined. A crowded party was being held during the 1986 World Science Fiction Convention at the futuristic Hyatt Hotel in downtown Atlanta, Georgia. Over the hubbub of writers and readers and fans, I overheard a young woman conversing about her experiences as an archaeologist in the Peruvian Andes. Drink in hand, I approached her and introduced myself as someone interested in Inca technology. "Have you ever heard of the large carved stone that the Incas made?" I asked, "their model of a topographical landscape, complete with streams and irrigation ditches. It looks like a hydraulic recreation." The Sayhuite stone, as it is known, had been featured on a recent television show about Peru, and as an engineer, I was drawn to its implications. She said she was familiar with the carving and added, "there are several of them like that." "Have archaeologists ever found traces of mercury in any of those sculptured models?" I asked, "in the channels?" Surprised, she replied, "as a matter of fact, they have. We've always wondered what it meant. Why do you ask?" I know why there's mercury there, I told her. About that time, we were separated by others in the milling crowd and never saw each other again. Our conversation took place nearly 10 years after I read Pharaoh's Pump, a small book by Edward J. Kunkel, and entered into a correspondence with the author, who gave me written permission to rewrite his tome into a more readable version. Mr. Kunkel's thesis held that the inner galleries and rooms of Egypt's Great Pyramid on the Giza Plateau are the remnants of a water pumping system originally used for supplying water to a series of locks that raised the colossal monument's ponderous stone blocks during its construction. To test his theory, Kunkel had built a 1/12 scale pumping pipe model of how he thought the King's Chamber, Queen's Chamber, Grand Gallery, and various channels and valves and flaps would have performed more than 45 centuries ago. To his delight, the whole thing worked very efficiently, pumping more water than it wastes, the only version of its kind that does. Based on this early dynastic design, he was awarded a United States patent for a hydraulic ram pump. As an engineer with a long-term interest in ancient technologies and prehistoric civilizations, I was impressed by this experimental archaeology approach. Desiring to replicate Kunkel's theories on a tabletop, I envisioned building a great pyramid model that could be carried and disassembled to show its hydraulic details, perhaps with a glass plate down the center plane, allowing the fluid flow and operation of the theorized pump and valve system to be observed. But where water worked well enough at Kunkel's large scale, it would not perform identically on a tabletop model, although I was able to drastically miniaturize the dimensions of the Great Pyramid and its features, I could not equally miniaturize the physical properties of water. It has non-scalable properties such as density, viscosity, and surface tension. Within the tiny lines and small chambers of the model I planned, the subtle features of Pharaoh's pump just would not function properly. This is where the science and engineering of scale modeling come in. We have all seen pictures of model airplanes and model rockets inside wind tunnels where variations can be modeled and results measured and then applied to a full-scale item. Hydraulic engineers use similar methods to model the flow around ships, submarines, canals, locks, and other construction, still using water. The important lesson here is that large physical reality can be accurately scaled down to a smaller model of a manageable size. In engineering terms, the applicable value is called the Reynolds number. This is a ratio of certain flow forces, recalling a college course I had taken on dimensional analysis. I was able to calculate the properties of a fluid that would flow inside a 1 to 300 scale model the way water would in a real pyramid, about 35 times the density of water. The only available fluid that came anywhere close to that density was liquid mercury. Mercury was not perfect, just 13.6 times the density of water, but it was the closest liquid that would work when scaling down the Great Pyramid from 754 feet on a side down to 2.5 feet. If the ancient Egyptians or whoever else may have built the Great Pyramid wanted to make models with liquid mercury simulating water to test their theories and their knowledge, the substance was available to them. The oldest sample of mercury metal dates to about the 15th or 16th century BC. It was found in an Egyptian tomb at Kerna, stored in a small glass container. In my own case, after checking into the price of liquid mercury and finding out about the health dangers in dealing with such a toxic substance, I put the project aside, although I never forgot about using liquid mercury to simulate water in hydraulic models. Later in 1985, when Chinese government officials announced the partial opening of Emperor Qin Shi Huangdi's tomb, who died in 221 BC, photographs were published for the first time of thousands of life-size terracotta warriors that had accompanied their leader into eternity. But what caught my interest was a statement in press coverage to the effect that historians reported the tomb also featured a large topographical model of China with quicksilver, the various waterways of the empire, the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers, and even the Great Ocean itself, created and made to flow and circulate mechanically. I recalled my pyramid fluid flow modeling attempts and wondered if the ancient Chinese had reached the same conclusion, namely, that in order to simulate the flow of water accurately in a small scale, they had to use liquid mercury. Perhaps it was just the fact that liquid mercury was beautiful and living and being maybe being quicksilver would not readily evaporate as water would, and made a much more attractive scale model of China. However, for an emperor who had spent his reign building canals and initiated the construction on the Great Wall, it would not be surprising if his designers had made use of all the modeling techniques at hand for their plans. In an interesting aside, Emperor Qin apparently died of mercury poisoning, which may have well been related to his tomb-building project, a connection pointed out in this article for the first time. During the intervening years, the remainder of the collapsed tomb site has not been excavated, but I will be waiting to see what the Chinese eventually tell us. If the ancient stories are true and the tomb space itself remained well-sealed, ancient liquid mercury could still be there, as well as whatever pumping mechanisms which may have been used. I now work in a government environmental group, and a colleague there used to live in Peru, where he studied archaeology. Recently, he answered my questions about the ability of the Incas to produce liquid mercury by going immediately to the internet and retrieving articles about mercury production in ancient and modern times. He stated that one of the two major sources of mercury in the Western Hemisphere was still in Peru, and that mercury itself can be derived by baking the mineral cinnabar. In fact, he said they used liquid mercury to separate gold from ore, which has been done all over the world since ancient times. They had access to lots of it. Since before the 16th century Spanish conquest, Peruvian cinnabar and mercury have come from a town called Huanacavelica. With this information, I was newly energized about ancient Andean technology. After a few minutes of Googling versions and various terms relating to Inca, stone sculptures, etc., I uncovered photographs of the Sihuite stone located in the village of Conchasa in the Apurimac department or province. True to my memory, there it was, the top half of a stone some 13 feet in diameter, elaborately carved with the model villages, waterways, canals, and irrigation ditches. I examined its details. If this had been intended merely for passive show, as the fabled hydraulic Chinese relief map may have been, it would be essentially two-dimensional. However, I could see that there were many channels for downhill flow, waterfalls, lakes, catchments, and finally a depressed rim around the center perimeter with outlets where the liquid could be caught and reused. To an engineer with some knowledge of fluid flow and a specific knowledge of ancient modeling, this was it. A working, productive hydraulic model that could somehow demonstrate how invaluable water could be directed where it was needed, captured for lakes, slowed for irrigation, and impounded for other uses. Additionally, one of the internet travelogues specifically cited the Sihuite stone. This wonderful monument contains a hydraulic system that allows the deposited water in its superior higher parts to flow through channels and halls, watering all the stone sides. In other words, the model continues to show off its utility. It still works. Detailed inspection of available photographs and drawings of the Sihuite stone reveal many hydraulic features carved into the model, along with somewhat cartoonish representations of human and animal figures. These figures of living creatures may represent designations for different parts of the Inca Empire, much as we today may represent states or regions by vegetation, animals, or large monuments. For example, cactus, buffalo, the Golden Gate Bridge, and so forth. Some internet sources speculate that the Sihuite stone details represent various sites in the Inca Empire. This may be true and truer than they realize, being engineered models of the empire's advanced irrigation systems. Details include terraces, which may stand for the incredible waterworks of Machu Picchu, waterfalls built into many Inca structures, and stepped causeways, which may have been intended to control the velocity of flowing water. The Sihuite stone evidences interlocking fingers, or camelones, that obviously represent the Inca's sophisticated irrigation layouts. It is well established that these ancient waterwork techniques were far superior to those of the invading Spaniards and, in fact, have been readopted lately for greatly increased yields. The next steps in this analysis of ancient technology and technique will require accurate three-dimensional renderings, preferably CAD, with models of the entire surface of the Sihuite stone and any similar Inca inscriptions. It is likely that even more advanced features will be discovered, and this would be proof enough even for hardened skeptics and professional archaeologists. I would expect at the last to find tiny fountains, gate, shutoff valves, and other means of diverting, separating, and mixing flows. Given the advanced concepts of the Inca engineers, I would not be surprised to find expressions of the Bernoulli principle, which governs the velocity and pressure in waterways. Such evidence could include widened corners for slowing down flows and thinner walls indicating reduced pressure in fast-flowing channels. Roman engineers used this knowledge in their advanced waterworks, some of which still stand today. Because of the Inca Empire's wide variety of topography, with its narrow valleys and high cliffs, I would also advise archaeologists to look for strange constructions on this Sihuite model or elsewhere in the field, which might indicate that the Incas had their own version of the hydraulic ram pump that Kunkel favored as a means of building the Great Pyramid. Hydraulic ram features would take the form of narrow channels or tubes running down into the bottom of hollow carved stones, and smaller tubes that exit from these stone domes. Such pottery or stones may exist today, their functions ignored and completely unknown. Whether or not a pharaoh's pump was actually used to build Egypt's Great Pyramid, Kunkel may have been onto something. Ancient engineers all over the world in all cultures were intelligent, practical, and experienced in handling water, the one truly essential resource. This article represents the first time that hydraulic modeling with liquid mercury has been proposed as an ancient technology, as opposed to purely an ornamental feature. It is also the first time that mercury modeling has been proposed as the cause for residue traces of mercury found on the Sihuite stone. To my knowledge, liquid mercury for such hydraulic modeling has not been used since, and I am finally convinced, however, that the ancient Incas used their knowledge of liquid mercury in conjunction with hydraulic modeling to create and study the flow of water. They would have done this to design, improve, and optimize their advanced irrigation techniques and their incredible waterwork systems and their characteristic waterfalls, baths, and fountains. So that's the end of chapter 33. Chapter 34 is, did pre-Columbian America's master electricity? Thomas Alva Edison is credited with the discovery of applied electrical power, but other American inventors may have preceded him by many centuries. Although conventional scholars emphatically resist the notion that advanced technologies could not have existed in pre-modern cultures, a growing body of evidence nonetheless suggests that the ancient Egyptians and other ancient peoples employed electricity to light their temples, tombs, and lighthouses during the pre-Christian era. Even years later, but still some centuries before discoveries were made by Thomas Alva Edison, Jerusalem was bathed in the brilliant glow of electric light searchlights casting their beams from windows in the distant Christian Church of the Ascension on the Mount of Olives. The late 7th century Frankish bishop, Arculf of Prigoe, who visited and explored the Holy Land accompanied by Peter, a Burgundian monk and guide, described the details and effects of those 8 carbon arc lights. In the words of the Catholic Encyclopedia, St. Bede relates that Arculf, on his return from a pilgrimage to the Holy Land about 670 or 690, was cast by tempest on the shore of Scotland. He was hospitably received by Adaman, the abbot of the island monastery of Iona, to whom he gave a detailed narrative of his travels to the Holy Land with specifics and designs of the sanctuary so precise that Adaman, with aid from the extraneous sources, was able to produce a descriptive work in 3 books dealing with Jerusalem, Bethlehem, the principal towns of Palestine, and Constantinople. Adaman presented a copy of his work to Aldfrith, king of Northumbria, in 698. It aims at giving a faithful account of what Arculf actually saw during his journey, as the latter joined the zeal of the antiquarian to the devotion of a pilgrim during his 9-month stay in the Holy City. The work contains many curious details that might otherwise have been non-chronicled. The following 2 excerpts from the pilgrimage of Archelaus in the Holy Land reports, this translation has been made as literal as possible in passages where the exact rendering was of any controversial or archaeological importance, as in the description of the sites and building. Here follow the two excerpts when Al-Kuf continues to describe one of those buildings, a church on the Mount of Olives. In the western side of the church, we have mentioned before, twice, four windows have been formed high up with glazed shutters. And in these windows, there burn as many lamps placed opposite them, within and close to them. These lamps hang in chains and are so placed that each lamp may hang neither higher nor lower, but may be seen, as it were, fixed to its own window, opposite and close to what it is specially seen. The brightness of these lamps is so great that as their light is copiously poured through the glass from the summit of the Mountain of Olive, not only is the part of the mountain nearest the round basilica to the west illuminated, but also the lofty path which rises by steps up to the city of Jerusalem from the valley of Josaphat, and it is clearly illuminated in a wonderful manner even on dark nights. While the greater part of the city that lies nearest at hand on the opposite side is similarly illuminated by the same brightness. The effect of this brilliant and admirable crucation of the eight great lamps shining by the night from the holy mountain and from the site of the Lord's ascension, as Arkov related, is to pour into the hearts of the believing onlookers a greater eagerness of the divine love and to strike the mind with a certain fear with vast inward compunction. He also went on to add that this is also learned from the narrative of the sainted Arkulf, that in that round church, beside the usual light of the eight lamps mentioned above as shining within the church by night, there are usually added on the night of the Lord's ascension almost innumerable other lamps, which by their terrible and admirable brightness poured abundantly through the glass of the windows, not only to illuminate the Mount of Olive, but make it seem to be wholly on fire, while the whole city and the places in the neighborhoods are also lit. The ancient electric church lights had to cover nearly a mile to light up that far the side of Jerusalem. Other examples of such bright lights are portrayed on crypt walls under the temple at Dendera, which still serve as a reliable witness to the accomplishments of ancient Egyptians in the field of electric lighting. Did the pre-Columbian inhabitants of this side of the Atlantic likewise enjoy its benefits? Described as the French Isaac Asimov, popular science writer Robert Charrot postulated that ancient Americans may have advanced even beyond Egyptian electric battery technology, as described at length in An Electric Lamp. In his Forgotten World, Scientific Secrets of the Ancients and Their Warning for Our Time, he wrote, that there is an abundant evidence showing that in Brazil and all over South America, including Peru, Inca civilization was preceded by an unknown culture, equally powerful and probably more advanced. During 1601, the Spanish writer and traveler Barco Sinterra visited the ruins called El Gran Moco near the sources of the Rio Paraguay, that is, in the vicinity of the Sete Lagos, the Seven Lakes, in the middle of the Mato Grosso, near the modern town of Diamantino in Brazil. He found a kind of large, non-flaming light in good working order. It was certainly not powered by batteries, but it gave light uninterruptedly, and there is reason to believe that the source of the light was chemical and electrical. This is what appears from its description. A column surmounted by a moon or large sphere which brightly illuminated the surrounding area. After describing yet another similarly spherical lamp comparable to our neon or mercury vapor versions, he wrote of the radiant rock of Lo, the archaeologist Harold T. Wilkins discovered an extraordinary monument that seems to be related to the ancient spherical lamps. At Wailo, on the Pacific coast of Arequipa, Peru, stands the Tombo del Inca, the tomb of the Inca. It bears an ancient inscription that is said to reveal the location of the entrance to a tunnel leading to the ancient lost world of mysteries and gold, whose hidden door lies foul with gases behind one of Los Tres Picos, the Three Peaks, Wilkins believed that the tunnel is at the southern end of the Atacama Desert in southern Chile. The indecipherable description in phosphorescent at the top of the rock itself gives off a light that is like that of a lamp in El Gran Moxo. Educated at Cambridge University in journalism, Harold T. Wilkins was a renowned investigator, among whose outstanding reportage was coverage of early television experiments during the 1920s. His histories of piracy in British public schools were widely read and honored after publication, but his mysteries of ancient South America and in secret cities of old South America are particularly valuable because Wilkins spent many years in South America as a very active and original researcher. As such, his firsthand description of luminous spheres in Peru underscores the American application of electricity during pre-Columbian times. So that's the end of chapter 34. And next time we're going to be getting into chapter 35, the mystery in the sphere. And I think this is going to be getting into those giant stone balls, big black balls in South America. Yep, that's what it's going to be getting into. So that'll be good stuff, as it always is. Want to thank everybody for being with us here tonight. My website is theglobalreality.com. Please hit the chipping banner up and help us meet our goal and get entered into the contest. Of the drawing on Friday, we're going to be giving away a couple of prizes. So get in there, support our work, help us out, help us meet our goal, and we're going to keep on trucking forward, folks. With your help. Thank you so much to everybody out there. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. We'll see you next time. You guys have a great one. Take care.